When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome one and all to another episode of Moments That Rock. Each week we delve into the careers and experiences and moments that rock from artists, music industry insiders and people I met along the way. Today we have a very special guest, but as always we'll leave it for him to announce himself. Ah, that fooled you. My name's Tony Michaelides and I present this podcast. Anyway, I've been away for a bit, backwards and forwards, doing various bits and pieces, and I didn't want to miss out on a week, so I thought I'd share some of my moments that rocked my world. Who am I? Well, I've worked in the music industry pretty much all my working life, 30-plus years. Started in sales, then working with Island Records, my all-time favourite record label. I went on from there to go to Charisma to work with Peter Gabriel and Genesis, then back to Island to work in the very early days of U2, which is one of the moments that rocked my world. Further to that, I'm a public speaker, I'm an author, obviously I have a podcast because you listen to it, and there's some other stuff, we'll have to go back and read up about it. So, let me tell you about the first time I met U2 and saw them play live. It was a rainy afternoon in Manchester, and I'd been informed about this band, U2, who were playing the Polytechnic, a university in the heart of Manchester. Now, they were third on the bill, supporting Wahee and Pink Military. The heads up had actually come from a guy called Neil, who was the press officer at Island. He'd sent me a cassette of their debut album, Boy, a few weeks earlier, and insisted that I got along to see them. Now, insistent was the perfect, polite way to describe Neil. As he would forever remind you, and trust me, it was a whole lot easier to go and see them than not go. As it was looking fairly grim on the weather front, I wasn't too keen to venture into the city on my own. So, I was looking for any excuse not to go, and very much like the idea of curling up in front of the TV and watching some inane programme. Believe me, that's quite an attractive proposition when you're working endless hours, albeit in a job that you love. I asked my housemate, Cool Tunes Piccadilly Radio DJ at the time, then of course onto national radio, Mr. Mark Radcliffe, if he fancied coming along. And he was up for it. And better still, he offered to drive, which was a relief. Suddenly, the thought of going out was a little more inviting. I was more than happy to go. It was just the filthy weather that was giving me an excuse not to. So I'd heard the album and it sparked off a lot of curiosity. I would be working with them too, so sooner I saw them, the better, I suppose. And of course, there was Neil's persistence. A no-show would have been difficult to explain. We climbed into the car, drove down to the Polytechnic, arrived minutes before the band came on, found a secluded spot to park not far from the venue, hoping we wouldn't get completely drenched. The rain showed little signs of slowing, in fact, let alone stopping. I'd seen plenty of days like that in Manchester anyway. You only had to look at the sky. I just knew it was going to be there for a whole day. Our names were on the door, so we breezed in and made our way to the front of the stage. It was a standing room only venue, and with U2 relatively unknown, or in fact pretty much completely unknown in this country being England, I should explain, most of the people were congregating around the bar, as was the custom. We needed the band to come on to stop the irritating sound of clinking clinking glasses. They came out and Bono grasped the mic, announcing, "Good evening, Manchester, we are U2. Good timing. Here we are, guys, let the show begin." The crowd was relatively lacklustre, which was par for the course, I suppose. Let's get the headliners out. Get you lot off. We want Pink Military. It wasn't said, but it was felt. U2's set was made up pretty much of songs that would soon be coming from their debut album, Boy. That night we heard whatever was to become U2's classics. The raw energy of 11 o'clock TikTok and I Will Follow. We watched their set with great interest. Bass player Adam wasn't a novice, still learning to play, in fact. Sorry, I mean he is a novice. He was a novice, of course. You know, he just picked up a bass. But they had a solid drummer and an excellent guitar player who had a very distinct sound. He was later introduced in the band roll call as The Edge. What sort of a name is that, we thought? But there was something about this, the inquisitive singer who introduced himself as Bono. They all got weird names, The Edge and now Bono. The singer was confident, yet still kind of a little awkward, and kept throwing back his hair while leering out at the audience with a threatening, you better pay attention or else look about him. So, still relatively experienced, you could clearly see he was a frontman intent on playing to an audience, no matter how big or small. There was definitely something there, although he couldn't, in fact, quite work out what that something was. He had a certain manic nature about him that made you pay attention, as you didn't quite know what he might do next. I later came to realise that Bono rarely did either. He went from clumsy, bad dancer routine to peering at the audience as if seeking some kind of reaction, if not participation. You felt that this was a frontman in the making. Now, Bono had periods on stage when he got lost in the moment, for want of a better word. One of these came that night when he started to swing from the pipes above him. This proved to be not a great idea, as they were red-hot Central Eating pipes. By the end of the evening, his hands were bright red, in fact, their short set ended, the band said their goodbyes and left the stage, waving to a fairly kind of nonplussed crowd, clearly there to see the headliners, Pink Military. The night was still young, though, so we stayed around, ended up meeting the band. What impressed us was that after their set was over, they came out to meet every single fan that might wanted to meet them that night and mingled and chatted for as long as the others wanted to. It was a nice interaction with their audience and something they were to maintain for as long as was safely possible. After the fans had their meet and greet, we decided to go up and introduce ourselves and say hi. Although I had only just made the decision to return to Island Records, I hadn't as yet had the chance to meet them or their manager. I introduced myself and then Mark as the local DJ, of course. They were mightily impressed that not only a guy from the record company had come to see them, but he had also brought someone from the media. They were very humbled and happy, and this was to be the start of a really nice relationship where we got to know each other, not just as workmates, but as friends. At the end of the evening, we bade our farewells and left the venue, like you do. Slight problem. When we got to where the car was parked, it wasn't there. We were positive that that was where we'd left it, but it had been stolen. What a bummer. We walked up to the police station to report it missing, drenched as it was still pouring down. I felt sorry for Mark, actually. He hadn't had his car for that long, and like I mentioned, he was the one who offered to drive. Then again, it could have been worse. It could have been my car. I interviewed Mark for my podcast shortly before writing my book, and he reminded me that after we couldn't find the car, we went back into the venue and started ranting at the guys that the car had been stolen. I don't remember that. Can you imagine moaning at U2 that your car's been stolen? Mind you, they were kind of early U2, I suppose, if we've got an excuse. They were actually incredibly upset and apologetic, although obviously it didn't have anything to do with them. In fact, come to think of it, it was entirely their fault. If they hadn't been playing that night, we wouldn't have needed to go in the car. Anyway, drenched inside and out, we took a cab home. It was still pouring down. We stayed up half the night talking about this band we'd just seen. And we couldn't fathom out exactly what it was we liked, but we both decided there was definitely something about them that night that prompted our reaction, I suppose. The following week, I went to see them on three separate occasions, and each time we chatted more and more. They were very inquisitive about Factory Records and Joy Division and were mightily impressed that, as well as Island, I work for Factory, helping promote their acts. I went as far as to promise them, well, Bono actually, that when they were next in Manchester, I'd introduce them to the label's founder and head honcho, in fact, Tony Wilson. As it happens, that proved not to be too far away. Mark already offered to interview them for his show prior to the release of the record, and kind of that's in a way why we went to check them out. They were really enthusiastic. They couldn't believe that this guy had recorded sessions with Joy Division. Mark was one of the first to show interest in the band, in fact, together with a guy called Billy Sloan at Glasgow. As a double bonus, as soon as the interview was over, I drove Bono over to Granada to meet Tony Wilson, Mr. Factory Records, Bonner was elated, asking so many questions. So, we were starting to build a solid fan base in the media then, and the people were turning out to be the band's tastemakers, the right people at the right stations that would get involved and want to champion the band. It was everything you'd ever want. Slowly, that started to come together, and I was able to see a gradual rise in some who originally weren't that sure about the band too. As I got to know people in radio and TV and was starting to build up good relationships, it was encouraging for me that they would listen to everything I was working on, trusted me and would offer honest and forthright opinions so that I could relay the feedback to the band and the label. And that was particularly useful with a band like U2, because all the while, a band like that, they're hoping that the hard work would pay off, but you never really any guarantees that the support would last. We're actually at the crossroads and needed a break. Otherwise, it would have been impossible to keep the momentum going. Well, I suppose we'll keep talking about U2 as we're on it. So November that year was pretty incredible, in fact. There were a few of us at Island Records who believed in the band and were convinced that they could be huge. Rob and Neil in the press department had done an unbelievable job getting all the journalists along to see them play, and they were starting to get really good feedback. All their efforts culminated in a prestigious NME front cover at the start of the year. And up until then, there'd been no significant breakthrough at national radio or television, and we knew we'd struggle to survive on press alone. So, to maintain great press coverage, the print media would need to see other media pick up on the band. Their job was to create a buzz and set the trend. But if they went out on a limb supporting someone no one else did, they could be seen to be losing some credibility, to say the least. Influential as the British music press were back in those days, they were all so precious and prided themselves on being hip. It was really important back then that in order for you to get more interest from radio and television, you needed the buzz to initially build from the press. In effect, it was kind of a catch-22 situation. We were at the crossroads and needed a break. Otherwise, it would have been really impossible to keep that momentum going. Out of the blue, I received some amazing news. Tony Hale, a network radio producer and a contact of mine, loved the band. He inquired if they were available to record a session. Were they available? Damn right they were available. Around the time, I got confirmation also that Granada TV's network show Get It Together wanted to book them. It was a primetime kids show and I couldn't believe my luck. All my Christmases had come at once. Usually with a band at this stage in the career, you'd be lucky if you got them on a late night TV show. I say luck, but in all honesty, I'd been working really hard on the band for most of the year. We all felt we deserved this break. This was going to be the most significant result we'd had from national radio and TV in the UK. Now, others were really starting to believe in them, and we were starting to think, maybe, just maybe. These were hugely important programmes with excellent ratings. I was immensely proud that a major TV station like Granada thought they were good enough to book. I knew you two had been waiting for this opportunity and how much they actually deserved it. It was a pleasure giving them the good news. I was totally committed to this band. And just to add to that, talk about totally committed. After seeing them at the Manchester Polytechnic with Mark Radcliffe, who's now at the BBC, on the 31st of May 1980. Then the 4th of June was actually that other Manchester gig at the Beach Club. And then I went to see them two consecutive days after that. The 5th of June on the Leeds Fan Club gig and the 6th of June at JB Dudley's in Dudley. So I saw them four times in the space of a week. You've been listening to Moments That Rock with me, your host Tony Michaelides, and me, your guest Tony Michaelides. We'll be back after this.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
And now back with more stories from me, Tony Michaelides, about the very, very early days in 1980 with U2. I thought they were brilliant, great guys with a great manager. We'd become good friends, like I said. I believed in them, and in return, I had their trust and respect. I knew that I was the right man for the job. We'd grown up together, learning our trades as we went along, I suppose. They on one side of the promotional fence, me on the other. Every opportunity we'd been out there, meeting new people in the media and making both friends and fans. And at the same time, I was building a strong relationship with the media, especially those people at Granada TV in my hometown then of Manchester, UK. Well, I always felt welcome when I was going in there. Great people and real music people as well, as it happened. So harking back to that great period, I vividly remember the first TV show I did with them in Manchester. A television debut out of Ireland on Get It Together, broadcast all over the UK and presented by an owl, Ollie Beak. How do you explain to a band that an owl will be introducing them? Nevertheless, it was a very popular show and a fantastic opportunity, and the band were only too keen to do it. In the middle of their number, the director, for some unknown reason, decided to revolve Larry's drum kit, and suddenly he was playing upside down. Funny as it seemed, it was a significant opportunity for a band at this stage of their career. Suddenly, they were being seen by a whole new audience. In fact, you can see that on YouTube, that Get It Together performance. Trying to garner any amount of radio and TV was a long, hard slog. But U2 had the full backing of their record company, Island Records. Nowadays, if a band isn't starting to make a significant breakthrough or at least start showing signs that they could, it isn't uncommon for a label to drop them, which means that a band like U2, in fact, would never have had that opportunity to become such a major force. It's unlikely they would even have been allowed to make a second album in the current climate we are, in fact, with the music industry. They alone are a classic case study in mistakes, opportunities, risks, interpersonal skills, and pretty much every lesson you can learn from rock and roll. And they learn better than anyone. In fact, good opportunity to plug the fact that I'm going to be putting together a course about lessons learned from rock and roll and doing speaking gigs about just all that stuff. Because I don't think till the gratitude sets in, until kind of the roller coaster ends and you kind of look back and look at those moments, which I suppose is the reason that I decided to share those moments from other people in this podcast. I've been doing it 3 years now, and I've learnt some amazing things from some quite incredible people. So if you delve through this and listen to some of the interviews I've done over the last 3 years, hopefully you're enjoying them. My premise was always the same as when I did my radio show. If I enjoyed the songs, if I enjoy the stories, why wouldn't other people? So where are we? In the UK, there were people like John Peel back then who were always championing new bands. Sadly, however, U2 wasn't really one of those bands. Thankfully, though, I managed to get them their first national radio play of any significance when I got them into a studio for BBC Radio 1 in Manchester, where they recorded 3 songs for the Peter Powell Show. I Will Follow, A Day Without Me, and a track called Father Is an Elephant, which to this day remains unreleased. In fact, I have it on cassette in my cupboard here. Can you see it? No, right. The session was recorded at an old theatre in Hume, Manchester. Steeped in history, in fact. It was the studio where the Beatles recorded their first radio session back in the early 60s. The equipment was pretty minimal, all analog, and the sound had a definitive live feel with just drums, bass, guitar and vocals. Bono couldn't quite get his vocals right that day, so we all sat down over a cup of coffee and he went for a walk around the building, looking in every single nook and cranny to find a suitable place where he could attempt to get the right sound. We thought we'd lost him. Very embarrassing. But two floors up, he'd found a bathroom complete with dirty tiles and urinals. Urinals, should I say. And with his microphone lead trailing behind him, he began to sing. Somehow, as he stood there, leaning against the urinal, he managed to get this amazing echo off the porcelain tiles. He came back down, we all listened to it, and everyone agreed. That's it, perfect. Even though that song never made it onto the album, I remember the session like it was yesterday. It was at the beginning of the 80s and right in the middle of the Rock Against Racism riots. If anybody remembers those, who will have been back in Manchester. As luck would have it, between takes, Bono decided he wanted to take another walkabout, this time outside. I tried to explain to him that these were less than salubrious surroundings and it was a very delicate time politically, so maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all. Fortunately, I persuaded him against it. It proved to be a great experience for the band, and knowing they were in the very same place as the Beatles were all those years ago gave them a sense of kind of rock royalty, I suppose. Those early years working with U2 and watching them grow really were truly amazing. To remember those days and see what they became always brings back kind of fond memories. Why wouldn't it? I'm reminded of one particularly special moment, however. So we'll continue with U2. I have to admit, the memory is made up of various contributions offered up by friends who remember it a damn sight better than I do. All a bit embarrassing, but worth sharing. So, here we go. U2 were completing the fifth leg of the Boy Tour and played a headlining show at the Hammersmith Palais in London, England, on June the 9th, 1981. Coincidentally, the day after Bruce Springsteen completed his 16th and final date of the River Tour in Birmingham. The East Street Band had flown back to the US without Bruce, who stayed behind as he wanted to catch U2's London show. Naturally, we put his name on the door, together with a backstage pass. Should he want to say hi to the boys? As it happens, I found out later that Pete Townsend was at the Hammersmith Odeon, which was just a walk away, and he turned up at the gig as well. I know that for a fact, because when Adrian Boot sent me the photos, which are in his Urban Images collection, I'm backstage in one of them, which I didn't even realise I'd gone backstage. And not only that, Pete Townsend is in there as well. So that was quite a show. So, incidentally, I had a few memories post over the years on social media, and apparently got some of the facts totally incorrect. Facebook can be a great source when it comes to accuracy, and at least of all my mentioning that it was the December date and they were supporting Talking Heads. That happened, however, the previous December, so thank you to my friend Tash for correcting me on that one. Totally embarrassing. She came to the gig with me that night, and to be honest, she's my reference point for all things that did happen, instead of my guessing. Bruce mingled well with the crowd, felt genuinely relaxed, and was clearly enjoying himself. And a couple of people came up to him for an autograph, which is understandable, but for the most part, they left him alone. Come to think of it, I got so much of this wrong part from Bruce seeing you two playing at Hammersmith Palais. After everyone left, myself and Tash eventually left too, but it was around 1am, and there, sat in a van with the door wide open, with his legs dangling out, was the boss himself. My wife at the time, Marie, was a massive Springsteen fan, so I pulled out my ticket and asked him to sign the back of it. He politely obliged, and naturally, she was thrilled when I got home and presented it to her. Now here's the funny bit. When I posted it on Facebook and the true facts were revealed, as I mentioned, the first correction was the date. It was June and not December. Secondly, Tash, via a private message, asked me if I remembered getting his autograph. Of course I replied, how could I forget getting his autograph? Then she asked if I remember not having a pen. No, I didn't remember that. But not having a pen was hardly a big deal, was it? Why would that matter? To which she replied, do you remember whose pen you borrowed? No. Pete Townsend's? Oh my God. So apparently I had a U2 ticket signed by Bruce Springsteen with Pete Townsend's borrowed pen, and they have no recollection of the legendary Who guitarist even being at the gig till I saw that photograph. And now for the totally unbelievable bit. Adrian Boot, a renowned photographer, was there, and on seeing my Facebook post, then sent me a picture of me backstage, standing in U2's dressing room with Pete Townsend and Bruce. Owning up time, I don't even remember being backstage. It's so embarrassing, I don't even know why I'm admitting it. In fact, to add insult to injury, it happens I drove down with Andy Kershaw, a BBC radio broadcaster at the time, and someone I'd known for years. And yes, I don't remember that either. Now, you got to remember, this is 40-odd years ago, and I am, well, older than I was then. Maybe this was a dream, in fact, and whatever else happened, it was an amazing night, and I think, hopefully, you agree with me, well worth sharing. And just to think, at that time, I'm writing this, I can see things more vividly than I did on the day. And I wish I'd had a mobile phone back then. It would have been a lot easier to remember stuff if I'd just had some pictures. Anyway, I was really thrilled when I wrote my book and Adrian sent me the photograph with the watermark off. So there you have it. There's some recollections of my early days with U2. One thing I do remember was after that gig on the Saturday night in Manchester, like I said before, I went to see them three times the following week. Leeds, Stoke, if I remember, and a place in Shude Hill in Manchester, upstairs at a pub. The world name escapes me of the pub, I should remember, because I usually do remember that bit. But there were 11 people there, and four of them went with me. And it was incredible, because they kind of came on and did a sound check to Next to Nobody, and then came out and played, like I say, to an audience of 11, like it was a stadium. There was no kind of why are we here kind of mentality. And they played passionately and really like, it was almost like a private gig at your house. And what I found over the years was whenever I went to see U2 rise through the ranks, obviously my period in the 80s was phenomenal, working around Boy, War, October, and then the Unforgettable Fire, Under a Blood Red Sky, culminating the Joshua Tree. So for me, those will always be the most significant years for the band, apart from them exploding onto the scene. On here, you can reel back to an interview I did with Adam Clayton and The Edge that went out just around the Unforgettable Fire when the band really did explode. And also the other thing that was really relevant was Live Aid, and I did a phone interview again on here on Moments That Rock the podcast, which The Edge talks about this huge event coming up, and I asked him what songs were they going to do. And when you think what happened at that gig, it was quite unbelievable because they exploded. I mean, that had a global audience of something like 1.6, 1.7 billion people. And it's another lesson learned from rock and roll when Bono screwed it up by just deciding to go walkabout and pull a girl out from the crowd. And the band had no clue where he was because they were on a different level, just playing like 8 or 9 minutes of Bad. Anyway, that's another story we might share when I don't get a guest in time for this. But I hope you enjoyed it. It's kind of my early days working with this band who play in this kind of Spheres place in Las Vegas, if I'm not mistaken. Thank you for listening. This is the Tony Michael, this presenter of Moments That Rock, coming back in now. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, then rate it, subscribe, come back for more. And we will be back next week with another episode of Moments That Rock.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.